This podcast is brought to you by DKP & Co. Chartered Accountants. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
Okay, welcome to If You Know Your History, episode 45 here on Football Nation Radio, or Soccer Nation Radio, as Vince Ruggieri likes to call it.
Does he?
No, that's an in-joke on Twitter, don't worry.
Football Nation Radio.
If you've been following Twitter this week, he's been hammered again by people who want to call it soccer and some people want to call it football. And, you know, this whole problem would just be solved if people just did what I do and just call it soccer.
Yeah,
so... Anyway, we're with Ian Syson today, whose pinched nerve has him in a brace, locked in his chair. Is that right, Ian?
Oh, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And we're also joined by returning guest, Gary McKenzie.
Hello. Good afternoon.
He's taken an hour off from working to do more important things.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there is that.
So,
welcome, Gary. It's great to have you. Great to see your face.
It's good to be here.
All right. Shall we get straight into it?
Yep.
All right. First cab off the rank is the Mark Borich Express. I'm not aware of Mark having actually uploaded much stuff this week. However, he has come into possession of a number of programs and possibly videos as well. And he said it'll take him 3 weeks to do it, to upload everything. So you can imagine it's probably 6 months worth of stuff for everybody else. Match programs, I'm assuming videos. I assume this is stuff that Les Street has passed on to him when Les Street was cleaning out his house and he goes, oh, I found a whole bunch of stuff. I hope there's stuff in his videos.
He found the Subudio.
Did he?
Somebody found a whole heap of Subudio.
One of the figurines.
Kotze's mate on Facebook.
Well, we'll get to Kotze in as well because he's also come into possession of a very large number of match programs.
Right.
And for the Victorian audience in particular, this would be great because it has a lot of 1980s State League programs, I think. So, and probably even below that, I saw in some of the images, which Kotze's very good at giving you the taste of what he's going to give you. Yeah. So it includes like Croydon City, Altona City, and probably a whole bunch of smaller clubs as well.
He's a curator, isn't he? He's a curator.
It's and fantastic stuff. So, you know, good on Mark and Kotze. We can't wait to see what comes up. I'm sure it'll help fill in a lot of gaps for a lot of people. Me, selfishly, I hope there's some South Melbourne stuff that I haven't got yet.
You know, in soccer Twitter history faction, there are two types of people. There are the ones who find the data and upload the data and collect it and gather it all. And then there are the writers. And I'm starting to wonder if there's enough writing going on. Because we seem to be doing a hell of a lot of collecting and pointing and look at this stuff.
I think it's urgent preservation might be going on. There's a fear that this stuff might be lost and there's too many stories of these things being thrown in the skip.
Yeah, well, that's right. But we do need also to have somebody telling the stories, don't we? We need to have people going through this data and saying, right, here's a narrative that's worth repeating. I mean, that's what you're doing with Quilp, of course.
Yeah. We will get there.
What?
We will get there, but it's like we just have to get the start first. And it's sort of like what we talked a bit about about Andrew Howe's work last week. And as much as we can sort of criticise or be sort of wanting more stuff to be written about these players or these teams or whatever the case might be, we've got to get the data first.
Yeah.
Yep. There's too many gaps in... The stories quite often.
Yeah.
Go on.
My book is like, it's a story that is conscious of the gaps deliberately. You can tell a story with gaps and thematize the gaps and say, well, these gaps are here for very good reason. and you know the gaps we'll try to fill. So I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time.
That's possibly true, but I mean, even things like last week when I was using the new Trove, and I mean, it was a function that already existed on there to use, like, you know, it's sort of equivalent of the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
But I found something, or refound something that I've been looking for the best part of 10 years, bit of information. So until we get better at sorting and knowing what we have, the writing is almost necessarily going to take a back seat.
I found something during the week as well, which I'm going to talk about soon, which I hadn't seen before. Greg Downs and Lee McGowan hadn't seen it before. And also Matthew Klugman, people who really would have expected to have seen it. But anyway, we'll talk about that in a moment.
Can we just talk quickly about Trove, the new Trove? I know some of you want to have a bit of a whinge.
I mean, Trove is the greatest thing since sliced bread in Australian research. I mean, it's fabulous. So any criticism we make of Trove is from a position of love.
But Gary, I mean, some of your thoughts on the new Trove.
It's cleaned up the interface quite well. My own main issue is that if I was saying looking for soccer in Melbourne in 1884, for instance, if I was to put British Association Football Melbourne into the search engine and put that sort of date range in there, it will come up with a list of results. But with those list of results, it would have soccer in Victoria, 1885 or 1884 or whatever it is. And I could say, oh, Ian's been there or somebody else has been there. Or maybe someone's written Melbourne football. And I'll say, oh, that's actually about Australian rules. You don't see that in your search results now. So you have to go into every article to actually find whether that's new area or not. It was very useful to be able to see those tags before. Because you could quickly discard results that have already not relevant or discard results that have already been mined.
Yeah.
But now it just takes that extra time to go through your search results.
Ian, any thoughts on that?
I use Trove every week for 100 years ago today, and I put in the date I'm looking. I put in soccer and the date I'm looking for, the precise date I'm looking for. And before it would say, do you mean everything on this date? And I'd say, absolutely, yes. And I'd click that and it would give me only things published on that date. Now I don't get that, asked that question, and I've got to go onto the right-hand side of the screen and scroll down and configure my data using the drop-down menus, and everything I'm looking for is in the shaded out area. So I've got to scroll down and, you know, and make that light. So it's like five or six steps that I need to do when it used to be one. That sounds like a first world problem, I guess. But when you're doing this stuff all the time, that click, 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 it gets a bit repetitive.
I think possibly one solution that might be fairly easy for them to implement, I think, would be to have like a follow button, a follow option. So if you know a certain user has a particular interest and a lot of tags, that you could just automatically say, you know, I follow Ian Sison, so I'm happy to see all of Ian Sison's tags.
Yeah.
I think that'd be fairly easy to implement. And therefore, it also established the sense of building a network.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well. So, you know, I know Gary's ID, I know Ian's ID, I know whoever else uses it. They've tagged it. We all see it. None of us is tripping over each other. We don't interfere necessarily with what other people are doing and what people want to use the articles for.
Yeah.
But we know what we're using it for. And I think that'd be something actually fairly easy to implement.
Something that I asked them about previously as well was the ability to search by excluding my tags.
Hmm.
And that would have been a really useful thing. So I could search for British Association Football, excluding soccer in Victoria, because that's the way I've tagged it. And that would, you know, only find the new stuff that's been put up. but that apparently is too hard to do. So
that's a shame.
Yeah. Also, one little beef, and I'm really grumpy with someone in South Australia, is that someone is tagging still every reference to soccer in South Australia historically as AUFC.
And we complained about this last year, didn't we?
Yeah, and it's still happening, and it's really frustrating because I cannot see any, apart from the fact that they exist in the same state or the same town, I can't see any reason for that tag existing. And, you know, well, just ignore it, I guess, is the answer. But it's sort of, we know that someone's going to be misled by that. Mm. Right? So it's like if I started tagging things that weren't true, you know, and with all my tags, if I just said, you know, this is about rugby union when it was rugby league, you know, it's like, it's not right.
So that's our Trove whinge out of the way, I think. I think the only other complaint that I saw come up was you have to sort of dig a bit deeper to find the new publications.
Yeah, okay.
So people like Mark Borich, who are looking for the results, for instance, and more data, you know, have a particular page that look up for the new things that have been uploaded to Trove. Yeah. And I think that's a bit tricky to find now. Look, it's been something that they've been developing for 4 years, this new interface. So understandably, people are not going to be happy with any new interface. Yeah. It's disorienting.
Yeah, it's always going to be a period of adjustment, isn't it?
I know every time Blogger updates its interface, I just lose my mind. I'm like, why? I was happy with this. I was fine. I chose Blogger because it's the easiest, dumbest, you know, blogging tool to use, you know. But the world moves on. Speaking of moving on, Les Street went out and did us a bit of a favor, didn't he, last week? Because he went out to Walter Williams' grave. And found the grave.
Yep.
And he found Ian. What did he find?
He took some photos and he found an inscription from the British Football Association. And so it's one of yours. It's a memorial, soccer memorial, a legit one. But what we also know is that the headstone, the original headstone, is missing.
So we know there's a headstone?
Yeah, well, I think we do. What's your sense, Gary?
Well, I found on Ancestry.com someone had an old, looked like 80s copy paper.
Yeah.
And it had the list of the grave, that it was his grave, but the stone had been removed.
Right.
So there could have been a more significant monument with that plaque on it. Yeah. We just simply don't know.
Yeah, so, I contacted the cemetery. And I got through to COVID answer machine. And then I tried the Friends of Coburg Cemetery Facebook page, and I haven't had a response yet, but I'll redouble my efforts and get back onto that as soon as I can to find out, because it'd be great to find that headstone. And if they don't want to put it back up or restore it or whatever, then we might have a use to which we can put it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what that might be.
Paperweight in FFV.
Maybe the entranceway of an Australian Football Museum.
A little. I'm going to have a bit of a dig at Tony Smith from South Australia here. But I asked Mark Borich in relation to this, what colours did Preston wear back in the 20s? Because I thought about going to the grave and maybe doing something daggy like putting a ball on the grave in the right colours. And Tony Smith responded telling me that Preston wore white shirts with black and white hooped socks. And he's talking about Preston North End. So I said, I met the one in Victoria, Tony. He said, yeah, well, I guess the world revolves around Victoria.
It does at the moment.
Well, it does a bit, but, that's a criticism I'd make of Victorians, but I don't think it was justified in this instance.
Do you want to do 100 years ago today, or do you want to take a break?
No, I want to do 100 years ago today, but what I want to do is we talked last week about the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, and at the time we were talking about it, I was doubtful whether we'd get it. and very pleasantly surprised that Australia and New Zealand have been awarded the Women's World Cup for 2023. And coincidentally, in researching 100 years ago today, I found this. Now, how do I do the share screen thing?
There's a green button at the bottom.
Oh, it's disabled. Josh, it's been disabled again. Host disabled participant screen sharing. Anyway, so I can't do that. Okay, sorry. Share screen. Share. Is that it? Okay, so I'll extend that. So this is, you can see, can you see what I've got up there?
Plus or downs.
Yeah, that means the place of women.
Mm.
Girls on the football field, the first international matches. And this is on the 3rd of July, 1920. It's a report in the Sun, the Sydney Sun, on page 3. So it's prominent. First international matches, dash and pace win for France by Montague Grover. So he's going to be interesting because he's a good writer and he's obviously a ping ponger, a fumble baller, because we'll see that later. London, May 7. 10,000 people came to scoff and remained to barrack, or rather to cheer, for England hasn't yet learned how to barrack as Australia does. Well, there you go. That's an interesting claim. That 10,000 had braved a cold, drizzling evening to see the team of French girl footballers sent over the channel by the Fédération des Sciences Féminines Sportives de France play the third and last of its games against teams of English girl footballers. This was the only match played in London. The earlier games had taken place in the north of England, the first resulting in a win for England and the second in a scoreless draw. There was some difficulty about securing a London ground and it was necessary to play late. The kickoff taking place at the extraordinary hour, from an Australian standpoint, of 6:30 in the evening. So this is an Australian who was there observing the women play, and it's a very fair-minded, as you can see already. So he goes on to, he says, soccer was the game played, and although I attended feeling that football of any sort was a game far too rough for women, I must confess here that after watching this strenuously contested game, I'm of the opinion that as it was played that day, it is no more liable to danger nor to strain than, say, tennis, and not nearly so much as hockey or lacrosse.
Mm.
It's a better game than hockey or lacrosse in terms of safety. Although they played with a full-size men's ball on a full-size ground and for the full time occupied in competition, male matches, 35 minutes. Well, there you go. Not one of the 22 girls on the ground showed the slightest signs of distress. One of the English team was knocked out temporarily by a fall in the first half, and one of the French girls had to rest for a couple of minutes in the second. That was all. Nobody left the ground feeling one whit the worse of the game. Racial contrast. The teams were in striking contrast. The English girls must have weighed fully a stone more than their adversaries on the average. They were all big, strong, well-developed buses from Lancashire and Yorkshire. The French team were not even in build like the English. There were long, thin girls, short, nuggety girls, big, lumpy girls, and dainty, shapely girls. Facially, they were much more attractive than the English. Socially, they seemed to belong to a class several grades higher. The English girls came mostly from the factories of Lancashire, the French from the magazines and offices of Paris. If I were choosing a batch of 11 immigrants to send to Australia, I would unhesitatingly pick the English women. If I were issuing invitations for a picnic, that would be posted to the French. So
it started off pretty well and then ended up, yeah.
Yes, but it's hard to know how to deal with that. I still think that it's overall a pretty positive article.
It's very positive.
Yeah. So the English team dashed out, the very picture of health and vigour, and in black and white striped tunics, the Collingwood colours, short
or,
black...
Or Newcastle.
Or Notts County. Short black knickerbockers and black stockings. The French girls trooped out in a stately procession and bowed solemnly to the grandstand. They wore tunics of the horizon blue of the poilu, dark blue knickers and blue stockings. In the play itself, the national characteristics of the two races quickly became obvious. The English were pressed throughout, but they never showed a sign of knowing it. The nose of the bulldog slopes backwards, said Winston Churchill at the beginning of the war, in order that he may breathe without letting go. I love this stuff. I love it. It's, I probably don't need to read any more of that. I mean, if people are interested enough, they will read this. But the point of this is that it takes it really seriously. It takes the game seriously. It takes the competition seriously. It argues for its safety and argues that it's a good thing. Now, the reason, and there we go, they've got the two captains meeting before the game. We've got a picture of the teams that split in half. I'll try and engineer these to be put together properly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an action shot from one of the French players. The aims of the Federation. Let's go towards the end. The formation of the Federation, she said, was wholly an outcome of the war and is designed to build up the physique of the womanhood of France. Sport in its aim, but only as a means towards an end. Its basis is really a eugenic one, intended to develop the physique of France generally, that the next generation may be better fitted to meet the menace from the north.
Oh boy.
Well, Belgium?
Luxembourg.
The Federation does not apply itself to football alone. It takes in all those sports in which women took no part previously. For instance, it leaves tennis and swimming and golf to the governing bodies previously existing, but has made immense progress in forwarding athletics, football, hockey, and rowing among women. Hundreds of French girls who would never have attempted to do anything more strenuous than knit jumpers have been attracted to outdoor games. And only a fortnight before the football match, a cross-country race of 3 miles was run off successfully in Paris. Already, says Madame Milliat, there is a noticeable improvement in the health and physique of the members. And as the movement is only in its infancy, she anticipates that its furtherance will have a marked effect on the future of French race as a whole. So it's you know, it's very much that eugenic kind of goal, the aim of this. It's about improving the race. And this writer is certainly clear in his own advocacy that it's a good idea for women in Australia. Because I've got trouble with my arm, I haven't been able to do the OCR correction, and I've cut and paste. I've actually put the JPEGs of the article in this rather than make text. And otherwise I would have been able to do the text and actually find easier text I was looking for. Anyway, it's now, this is in 1920, it's published in The Sun in Sydney, and it's an advocacy of the appropriateness of women's football. And what happens in the next 2 years in Australia? Women's football explodes. As Peter Eadie pointed out, there's a game in a year's time from this in Brisbane, that's the North-South game. 10,000 people turned up, and rugby league gets a real move on in Sydney. All coming from these sorts of impetuses, coming from the war, the participation in the war, the sporting participation, and so on.
As it turned out, though, there'd been earlier women's soccer games due to the war.
Yeah.
One in 1918 in West War's End, where they were raising money for the soldiers.
Yep.
But you touched there on the women in the factories in England. Some of them were playing in Australia in 1920 in Murray Bridge.
Right.
Now, I found the story from that I wrote about this last year. It was a women's versus men's in skirts match in support of the local hospital. Now, that sounds like it's just a novelty game.
Yep.
But I do have a short paragraph here from the Mount Barker Courier and Onkaparina and Gumaracha Advertiser from October 1920. On Saturday, October 9, prior to the soccer match to be played on the showground between two Adelaide teams for the benefit of the hospital funds, a match will be played between 11 girls of Murray Bridge against 11 composed of the local male soccer enthusiasts who will be attired in skirts. During the war, the female munitions makers in England took the game of soccer in large numbers, or took to the game of soccer in large numbers. And there were many exciting contests played between representatives teams of munitioners in the various parts of the country. Included in the local ladies team will be several girls who played the game in England, and the game, though much in the nature of a novelty, will not at all be a one-sided affair. So in this novelty game, there are actually experienced women soccer players in Murray Bridge in 1920. So I'd say a certain amount of immigration of women who'd played it had already taken place. And that would have also have helped the 1921 explosion in Sydney and Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, these both articles point to, and other articles point to, this rapid growth of interest in women's football. What it doesn't point to is the stomp that comes on the game as a result of the FA's decision to threaten any grounds that hosted a women's game and effectively banned the women's game in England. And the rugby league actually used that same principle to ban women's rugby league in Sydney.
So what happened in France, though, to stop their players?
I'm not sure.
Well, that's the next thing we've got to find out. They've got to ask Gene Williams.
Did they stop? That's the question. But I thought this was intriguing, and it's substantial. It definitely is, to my mind, an advocacy that's published publicly in a leading paper in Sydney.
Yep.
And it's 100 years ago exactly that it was done. So it's almost like the World Cup is a sort of a fruition.
I mean, sort of to conclude this discussion and before we go to a break, I mean, despite the best efforts of a number of people, you know, working in this field, the mentality is, or the public perception is, that women's soccer in Australia still starts 1970s or post-1970s. Yeah. And that's no doubt important. That's where the modern women's game in Australia takes hold. That's where it comes from. That's its origin. But part of our job and part of all the women's soccer historians' jobs is to go back and especially emphasize, you know, women's soccer in the 1920s and 30s and before that, and figuring out where it stopped, you know, and what was its nature in between those two large peaks or those two, you know, sort of self-contained communities.
Game stops.
Yeah. But I think it's time to take a break. And after the break, we'll continue on with chatting with Gary and Ian, and we'll catch you after these commercials.
Okay, this is formation history.
Yeah.
Not Football Nation history.
Yeah.
If you know your history on Football Nation Radio, sorry.
Yeah, we've got Ian broadcasting from the Plague State.
Plague State, yeah. And the
Me too.
And so there's myself and Paul, and we've got with us Gary McKenzie.
From the proven right state.
And the lovely 25 degrees outside state.
Is it really? Oh, but the weather's glorious here. Really,
it's beautiful. It's great. Yeah, I haven't gone outside yet, but
yes. Well, now it's time for
100 years ago today.
I heard that.
So,
yeah, nice.
We've got a follow up on the Walter Williams story, the very tragic story of Walter Williams that we looked at last week. On Saturday, the 3rd of July, 1920, this was published in the Age. Miss Jean Thomas desires to thank her many kind friends, especially fellow players, Preston British Football Club, N&D Football Club, and Amateur British Football Association. Now, there's a little frisson of excitement there too, because her fellow players, is she playing? No, I don't think she is. She means Walter's fellow players. And Amateur British Football Association for floral tributes, cards, and letters through the loss of her dear friend, Walter Williams. So I'm speculating.
You think it's a euphemism?
Well, I don't even think it's a euphemism. I just think that's the way you describe your boyfriend.
Yeah, probably.
What do you reckon, Gary? That's a boyfriend?
It sounds like no other family is mentioned there, so.
Yeah, it's and this adds one more layer of grief. Layers of grief.
Is a phrase. Were you able to trace her through the years?
Well, we will. We'll
okay.
When you and I write this big biography of Walter Williams, we'll be doing that. Okay, so the age, on the 29th of June, 1920, I'm doing this to get the results of the, is my screen still being shared?
No.
Okay, well, we don't want to. There's a big match report. We've got actually names of the Albert Park players and the Northumberland and Durham players. And Robeson is playing this week. So he effectively killed Walter Williams last week. And it hasn't upset him to the extent that he's had to have a game off. He's played the week after.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the team list and there's a match description. But I'll give you the result later. Okay, the other results are Melbourne Thistle 1, Burns 1. St Kilda, 3. St David's, 0. Windsor, A, 6. St Kilda, Windsor, A, 6. St Kilda, A, 0. And Albert Park, 0. Northumberland, Durham, 3. That's a big win there to the lads. And next weekend's games, or tomorrow's fixtures, are going to be St Kilda versus Burns at Middle Park, Melbourne Thistle versus Northumberland and Durham at Middle Park. We'll hammer them. Welsh United versus Albert Park at Middle Park, St David's versus Footscray Thistle at Middle Park. So there's four different grounds. Did you have a sense of where the grounds are, Paul?
Yeah, roughly Footscray, Middle Park, Preston. I don't know. Do you want the Middle Park ground specifically?
At Middle Park. There are four games going on at Middle Park.
All over the place.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing very close to the Middle Park Hotel.
Yeah.
So that's where the Middle Park railway station used to be. Now it's a tram stop.
Yep.
I think the street is Fraser Street. That's where Middle Park Oval 18 is. And park rangers played on Middle Park number 7, like 20 years later, 25 years later. So I'm imagining it'd be three or four different grounds unmarked for the most part, unfenced, probably very close to the Middle Park Hotel in Fraser Street on the boundary of the South Melbourne St Kilda Councils. That's my guess.
Okay. All right. So anyway, it is a hub anyway. It's a hub of soccer every Saturday.
And I'm guessing as well, as far away as possible from interfering with like the footy ovals.
Yeah. The reserve teams, Preston are playing Melbourne Thistle. And Windsor are playing Spotswood. Interestingly, the senior Preston team appears not to be playing. I'm not sure whether that's some sort of response to the Williams situation. Okay, back up towards Gary's part of the world, the Glen Innes Examiner on Thursday, the 1st of July. The Soccer Code, Armidale versus Glen Innes. The first intertown match in the history of the Soccer Code in New England was played on South Park, Glen Innes, yesterday afternoon. The contesting teams were representatives of Armidale and Glen Innes, and the exposition was one which lead weight to the prediction that soccer has come to stay in New England and, within the course of a few years, will have achieved a very widespread popularity. Apart from the fact that there are many good soccer players in northern New South Wales, there are supporters of the Code imbued with so great an enthusiasm that no obstruction will damp their ardour. At the present time, there are soccer clubs in Armidale and Glen Innes, and it is expected that within a very short space of time, the game will be introduced at Kentucky. Where's Kentucky, Gary?
I think it's a little bit west of Armidale, one of the small little villages
right
between it and Tamworth.
Other towns in the north are feeling their way, and next season should see soccer firmly established in New England. It's a long article, so go to the New York Osmos blog if you want to read that. And then there's a description of play and so on. And
I used to live in Armidale, so it's still a very strong soccer place. There is a northwest New South Wales Premier League, with most teams are from Armidale. There's some from Inverell, I think. Moree, and also Glenelg Highlanders. And of course, you've got the university there, so there's a lot of soccer there as well. So it did survive quite well.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I've looked up Kentucky here in New South Wales. It's just south of Uralla.
Yeah.
And that's just north of Kentucky, would it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I've got one more. No, I've got two more. I've got one, they're both short though, the Newcastle Sun. Now, this is really interesting, not for what it's about, because it's just, you know, it's a result. Wall's End versus Westie. The principal soccer match today was at Wall's End Park between Wall's End and West Wall's End. There was a good attendance. At halftime, the score was 1-0 in favour of Wall's End, for whom C scored, SEE. I wonder if he's an Asian player.
Yeah, it's possible.
The home team had much the better of the play. Owen missed a penalty. And that's it. And what made me realise is that this is a halftime result being published just after, I mean, as the game's being played. And it goes to show the extent to which soccer is embedded in Newcastle. You know, we've got to wait a week in Melbourne for the results to get in. And here we've got a result at half time before the game's even finished, published in the afternoon paper.
We'll need our Newcastle friends to follow up on C, just to see, no pun intended, who he was.
Yeah. So that's right. I mean, who was Mr. C, SEE? And the final one, I looked in vain for an Ipswich one, Gary. It's almost like there weren't any articles this weekend.
But old sport must have had the week off.
Well, this might have something to do with it. The Brisbane Courier, Wednesday the 14th of July, men from the renown. This is my running gag. Toowoomba, July 13. The mayor of Toowoomba has been advised that two officers and 35 men from the renown will visit Toowoomba on August the 6th and will play a soccer football match against the Toowoomba team and probably get hammered. No, it doesn't say that last bit. So the renown tour is ongoing. It's probably an interesting article in the Tour of the Renown 2020. It's probably an interesting story to tell there.
So that's it for 100 years ago today?
That's 100 years ago today.
All right. Moving on, for the reason we got Gary in the first place, right, Ian?
Yep.
Talk about Quilp.
Now, yes, Quilp.
Let's talk about Quilp. Who was Quilp? Because a lot of our audience would have no idea who Quilp was.
Quilp is potentially the earliest known Aboriginal soccer player that we know about. He's around at the same time as Bondi Neil starts. His first known game was for Reliance FC in Ipswich in about 1904, but he appears in a end of season awards night and concert for Dinmore Bushrats in 1899, and is seen hanging around and playing quicks actually with various Ipswich soccer players as early as 1897. He's a lot older than Bondi Neil, as in he was born earlier. So it's not unlikely that he played considerably earlier than Bondi Neil did. However, we are trying to find out more about him, because he did lead a very long and interesting life, most of which had nothing to do with soccer at all. Right. But that in itself is rather fascinating, because he ends up at one point shaking the hand of Prime Minister Billy Hughes in 1922. He becomes a sort of a minor local celebrity in Tweed Heads in the 1920s, for instance. So what we've been trying to do for the last 2 years, I know Ian's been looking into him since about, 2013?
Yeah.
Is to find out more of his story. And slowly as Trove is putting more things up.
To put listeners in the picture properly, Gary, I'd sort of let out on this, but you really have taken up the baton and it's your story now. I've found this guy in the middle of this really high-res, good quality high-res photo of the Dinmore Bush Rats. Which team was that? Was that 1910?
1910, yep.
Yeah. And it was, so I used to look at all these photos and go, oh, look at these beautiful old photos, and without really any sort of forensic sort of analytical interest. And they're right in the middle of this photo is an Aboriginal guy. And I, you know, it's WTF, what's going on here? And so it was like, that really sparked me into discovering what I could about Quilp. And I put a couple of pieces up on my blog and made some speculations, some of which were wrong. And you'll probably explain how I was wrong. We kind of came to an agreement where you would sort of take up the running on this.
Well, you asked me to update the article, but so much more information has been found, it needs a complete rewrite.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing at the moment is trying to put everything we know into the written word. I'm not trying to do a Paul Nichols literary article because I feel we still don't know enough to be able to do that. But I'm trying to, partway through writing, just a factual biography of what we know so far and to point out what theories are definitely being not true.
Yeah.
Just so we can know where the actual research is at, because I've found a lot more stuff appeared on Trove since you were looking, but I've also managed to get some information out of the Queensland government from the Department of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships, which that in itself seems to indicate that Quilp has no known family, because if he did, I wouldn't have gotten any of that information. So as far as we know at the moment. So I guess where I'm at is just to sort of give a potted history of Quilp and where there's further needs for further research. The other thing that really gets me about Quilp is that it's not really a soccer story. He plays soccer. We also know he was a referee, but he was also an Aboriginal man at a time of great change in the policy of Aboriginal people in Queensland. And it's intriguing to know how he did and did not experience what Aboriginal people experienced in Queensland and Northern New South Wales during his life. So what we know about him is that he was born around 1870, give or take. His obituary gives him an age of 63, but apparently his gravestone is there in Moolumbah that said he was born in, or he was 60, which would have put it back to 1870. And we know he lived from a young age with a grazier called John Ashburn. Now, John Ashburn had properties out near Blackhall and Barcaldine and further south in the Warrego area of Western Queensland. And then he moves to Ipswich to become a butcher to sort of some of his stock he then sells to people as meat. We don't know anything. Quilp does not appear anywhere as in contemporary accounts up until John Ashburn's death in 1897. We just know from articles later that he lived with Ashburn. What we do know is that Ashburn dies in 1895 and the family are forced to sell the farm in Ipswich in 1897. And that is where it seems that Quilp stops living with the family. And that's where he first appears. Unfortunately, for being arrested for drunkenness, which along with the policy of the time, they fine Aboriginal people, and then go heavily after those who gave the alcohol to them, so the publicans. But also the same year, he's playing quoits with members of Ipswich soccer teams. There's a quoits competition that lasts for a few years. And that's where we start seeing him as a sports person. Over the next 13 years, he plays soccer, he boxes near the end of that time, and he continues to play quoits. But then, and we know that he works in a pottery as a foreman or a number of potteries rather than in mines.
As a foreman?
As a foreman, yes. And there is a court case against one of these publicans where he's actually, this is the parlance of the time, and we wouldn't, you know, we have to say that, but they're saying that he's a civilized black man. He, you know, like he's educated, he's well-spoken. Yes, he was in a pub having a drink, but you'd almost treat him like a white person. And why are they making such, why are they going after the publican for this individual? And that wasn't even an Ipswich paper. That was a Brisbane paper. He seems to have no known links with any other Aboriginal person in Ipswich at the time, including the well-known Deeving Creek cricket team. So he seems to be in this white world, because a lot of the times he appears, it's with members of the Bushrats in social situations. However, in the late 1890s, there's a new law brought in where if an Aboriginal person was not unable to work, and that included the elderly, the young, the disabled, they were removed to missions. So after that famous photo, a few months after that, Quilp was removed to the Brambar Mission. He was arrested for drunkenness in December, and we don't know if he paid the fine or spent a month in jail. It's possible he could have learnt he's lost his job. He'd started a new job at a newly established brickworks a few months earlier, and he was sent to Brambar Mission. What's interesting about that is that just before then, the police in Brambar tried to give him a travel permit to get a job up in, I forget where it is now, further up in Queensland, near Blair Athol Mine, actually, where an ex-former bushrat ran the mine up there. And that got knocked back. And then after he was moved to the mission, the community actually put in a petition to try and get him back. So the community wanted him there. He was part of that community. And I'm not sure how much that is the experience of Aboriginal people at the time. Definitely not the rural ones, I'd assume. But he seems to live this life in this white community. What happens next, though, is that he's selected to appear as an exhibition at the Brisbane Ekka. They would have things called Aboriginal courts, where they would have the Aboriginal mission send craft and also people to show off what work they could do. And the whole idea was that they would show that these are good workers. They would go out and work hired out by the missions. And of course, who would get the money? Queensland government would get the money. So that was his life up until about 1912. And then it seems to be that he's then let go back to Dinmore to make bricks. But that's the last we hear of him in Ipswich and in Queensland. And that's when he turns up in probably the last 15 years of his life, which is far better documented, under the name of Jackie Lynch in Murwillumbah.
So was my red herring, or the error I made was to see him as somebody who went out buffalo hunting.
Well, I think the assumption there was because the buffalo hunter came from Toowoomba, that it was the same Quilp. And also it wasn't, you made the assumption because someone asked where Quilp was in the Ipswich paper about 1919.
Yeah.
And they actually asked, they'd read about Quilp, this other Quilp buffalo hunting with a Toowoomba buffalo hunter, and made the connection.
Yeah.
But we know this other Quilp. There's a street named after him in Darwin, actually. He was a lot younger, and we know who he married.
Quilp, what does that come from?
Well, what we th- The old curiosity shop by, Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens?
Yes, Charles Dickens, was released about 1840 and was quickly printed in news, in papers in Australia. And it very quickly, that the quilt, the little hobgoblin-like person who was the antagonist in that, quickly became a piece of cultural, it got used in Australia for other things. Horses very quickly, a lot of quilp horses and Mr. Quilps and Mrs. Quilps, but it just got a life of its own in the next decades. So there were football columns written by quilp, people called quilp. There was at least two of them, one in Adelaide, one in Sydney. There was Quilp N, was the non de plume of a poet in Sydney. There was a
player in the 20s called Quilp, isn't there?
Yeah, from Ipswich, who's a different person. And there was the unfortunate governor or premier of Queensland around 1900 was called Philp. So the newspapers kept having a go at him, saying he was a Quilp-like person. And So it, by this stage, Quilp had far surpassed the book and the many plays that were made and staged in Australia. There were a lot of plays. So exactly whether that was why he was called Quilp, whether it was named after a racehorse, whether it was just a name that had transcended all known meaning, even whether he had that name while living under Ashburn, we don't know.
There's the town Quilpie.
Yes.
Comes from a bird, doesn't it?
It does. And I did look at about 12 months ago that the language groups, Aboriginal language groups, there was this diagonal chain of them around the farm in the Warrego at Hogan Thala that Ashburn owned, down through the Quilpie area into New South Wales. So it's a different dialect at Quilpie, but it could be the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where, so we've done, well, look at what Ian sort of started off with, and we've done what you've got to now. I mean, what's the next step? I mean, do we just keep waiting for more trove information, or do we start plotting an article?
What we need to do is to talk to the community in Moranbah. So that's where he lived the last 15 years of his life. He often made appearances with his wisecracks, whether they were laughing with him or at him. We have to be careful about that.
Both.
But he seemed to have given as good as he got.
Yeah.
But what we have to be careful of is that I found a piece of spoken oral history taken in 1983 where a woman who was born in 1910 talked about who lived in the area at the time, an Aboriginal woman. And on the list of names, she said Jackie Lynch. So obviously he was, we don't know what mob he came from. He could probably from the Gulf Country. We know he lived most of his life in a white community, but he seemed to have become part of that multicultural community in northern New South Wales. Many of them had fled from the laws sending people to missions because the laws were a lot more, lot less in New South Wales. So they joined the Aboriginal people already there. And there is a cultural centre in Moranbah that I was hoping to visit, but then COVID's completely knocked that out. I have spoken to the library. I have spoken to the cultural centre and the historical society. And they have just sent me the same articles that we've already found on Trove. And there was an article written in 1980s about him, but it turned out that was just paraphrasing the same newspaper articles from the 1920s. However, they did turn up a picture of him, a professional picture taken by the photographer in Moranbah or Tweed Heads with a hat on. So he obviously could afford or was enough of a known character to have a proper photo taken of himself.
This story is an example that I referred to before where the gaps are interesting as well.
Yes.
The gaps tell a different kind of story. So it's not going to be a story about an Aboriginal soccer player. It's a story about trying to find this man's biography.
Yes.
And why can't we do a good job of it? And there are all sorts of reasons why we can't do a good job of it. Some are pernicious, some are just accidental. And
can we find members of the Ashburn family and do they want to talk? A historian up here who studies a lot of Aboriginal people said, for instance, at the time Quilp was born, up in that area of Queensland around Blackall was, for use of the, again, a word we didn't want to say, frontier land. It was where there were clashes between the people coming in and the Indigenous people of those areas. In fact, I think the mob from the Blackall area fairly much don't exist anymore.
Right.
I've been reading articles. A lot of them got wiped out, give or take. I've read articles with people who are looking after land but can't claim native title because it wasn't their land. But we can't make the assumption that Quilp was a stolen child.
Yeah.
Because he said he'd studied a lot of these, and it's a perfectly reasonable assumption to make on the surface, but he'd studied enough to know that often that wasn't the case for individuals. So there's a mixture here of what was happening in Aboriginal, how Aboriginal and white societies were coming together throughout this whole period, but what was happening to the individual. And they don't necessarily align with the general things that were happening and what was happening to Quilp as a person.
So it's still a
worthwhile thing to try and investigate, but we can't make the assumption how he came to be with the Ashburn family, how he came to be working in the Potters. We simply don't know. And I think the difficulty of writing anything denser is because we can talk... I think we have to do justice to what was happening to Aboriginal people at the time.
So what I would say then is there's two things. One, obviously our interest has been piqued in this person by the fact that he's a soccer player at one point, and the fact that he's an Aboriginal soccer player. So we're always on the lookout for something like that. But he doesn't belong to soccer. His story is not a soccer story per se.
No.
And anybody who's sort of looking at this has sort of got to get their head around that.
I was thinking about this in relation to Bondi Neal. Even though Bondi Neal was a good cricketer and a good rugby player, his is a soccer story because that's where he becomes an identity. He becomes an important figure on the South Coast afterwards. So all roads lead to soccer in Bondi Neal's story, whereas for Quilp, soccer is just something that happened.
I think in both cases, though, and especially in Quilp's case, the more important story is their lives as Aboriginal people in what was a very difficult time to be an Aboriginal person in this country. And trying as best we can to give a holistic, a complete picture as much as possible. I mean, with all the gaps, noting that he worked in a variety of jobs, that he was sort of a spectacle and was sort of aware of this as well, that he exists in white society, that we don't know who his people are, that it's a very complex story and soccer is just one part of the story. And we don't even have the complete soccer story either because, as sort of Gary's intimated, it's probably pretty safe if you can assume that he's probably played soccer before, you know, what we have on record. Would you say
we've got about four games that he gets banned for half a season for getting sent off at one point.
And that's the game where he's sent off and then scores.
Yes. So the week later they say that he got sent off and then banned for the rest of the season. The other guy from the team simply gets 2 weeks off, but he didn't get sent off. Right. I think Quilp verbaled the referee. Mm-hmm. We don't know what was said. So is that, I've never read anyone else being suspended for the rest of the season at all. But especially at that level, how much of this stuff gets written about? Was it written about because he was Aboriginal or was he banned for half a season because he was Aboriginal? Yeah. And is that reading too much into it? We've got to be careful.
I think probably the best way to actually go about maybe producing a work on this is, in the same way that Roy Hay did that sort of like a little book on the Vietnam War tours that the Australian team did in the 1960s and early 1970s, just you know, get it out there, get the images out there, whatever we've got. So this is what information we've got out now.
Yeah.
Just a nice little quick book, easy design, doesn't have to be too intense. I think this is very doable, actually.
And that's what I'm trying to do at the moment, just give a straight, this is what we've got, these are the information, the pictures. We need to find out a lot more, and we need to talk to appropriate Aboriginal people, especially at Moolumbah, to really find out more about this, because they would know more about why people fled to New South Wales, how they integrated in that society. As I said, the oral memory, oral stories of him as late as 1980. So,
yeah,
you know, they would hold a lot more information about, especially the last 15 years of his life, I think.
Yeah. And that's what you've got to sort of get onto next, because that's the big,
big picture. And that becomes their story as well.
Yes.
So absolutely. What can we tell? There's a lot of sensitivities around these things.
Yes. There is this is the dilemma for non-Indigenous people writing about Aboriginal sportsmen as well, isn't it? Like, it makes me think of the Buddy Newchurch story. And it's a very difficult story to tell, to get involved in, and it's really easy to say, oh well, I won't bother. I've done what I've done, and I can't go any further. I mean, the stories are easy to tell of people like Charlie Perkins or Harry Williams, who are, you know, public and well known, and you know, they're avowedly soccer people. The other stories are just—it's the dilemma that we have.
And, you know. I admire Gary's tenacity with it, and I think he's approaching it in the right way. He's trying to tick all the boxes, trying to talk to the right people, trying to be thorough and correct with the way he's going about this. And we really look forward to what eventually comes out of it. It won't be a complete story. It can't be.
No.
And as long as you're at peace with that, as long as the audience is at peace with that, I think it'd be really interesting to see what comes out of it, because...
We have Brian Matthews' Louisa, which is a biography of Lawson's mother. And it ends up being a story about how he's unable to write the story.
So with that, I think we're kind of running out of time now.
I'm unfortunately, Paul.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll be back next week.
Yep.
Ian?
I'm alive.
You'll try.
What's that? Now, the next week, there's a plan. There's a possibility that I will visit Roy Hay on Thursday morning. And we could well do this, to have a three-header with Roy involved.
Okay.
That's fingers crossed, because that'd be terrific. He'd be in one end of the room, I'd be in the other end of the room, social distancing. And who knows?
Well, we'll try to figure out during the week. But in the meantime, thank you to Gary. Thanks, McKenzie, mate, for appearing on the show and helping us out.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You do, mate. Thank you for everything you do on the web. This is a horse race. You're actually in the lead, mate. So, you know, there's plenty of people chasing you, though. Mark Warwick is always there. He's a stayer. Your work is just awesome.
And thank you very much.
All right. I think that's it for this week, and we'll catch you next week. This has been If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.